Now, the United States has withdrawn from the United Nations Human Rights Council. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley announced the decision last week.
For too long, the Human Rights Council has been a protector of human rights abusers and a cesspool of political bias. Regrettably, it is now clear that our call for reform was not heeded.
Pompeo and Haley cited anti-Israeli bias on the council and said that many nations on the council had serious human rights problems of their own. Our next guest is here to talk about the role the council plays, what it means that the U.S. has decided to leave the group, and what signal it sends to the international community. Michael Schroeder is senior professorial lecturer and assistant dean in American University's School of International Service. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, the Trump administration's been threatening to leave this Human Rights Council for about a year. What was your reaction when they actually did it?
I don't know if I had a particularly strong reaction in the sense that, like I said, they had sort of said last year that they were, reviewing it and then sort of made a strong threat using often the same kind of language and criticisms of the council that they did when they did. I'm not surprised, but I'm also at the same time, I don't think I knew it was coming or anything like that. I think this administration sort of held its cards close, at least to the sense, although they were certainly made very clear their concerns about the council, and even before this decision had made clear that they were not happy with how their reform agenda sort of was unfolding, or the pace at which it was unfolding in the UN General Assembly, which is kind of the overseeing body where a lot of these changes that they wanted to see would ultimately have to be approved.
Before we dig into the reasons why the U.S. left the organization, big picture, are we better or worse off as not being part of this council?
I think it's sort of my own view is that I think we're probably overall worse off in terms of the United States being able to influence both the sort of long-term changes in the structure of the membership, which is one of the big concerns, what's on the agenda, and in particular the kinds of resolutions the United States has been really concerned about, especially resolutions singling out Israel and its human rights practices. In terms of the council itself, I think that remains to be seen. Certainly the council has worked without the United States before. Its first years of existence up until President Obama decided to join the council, it operated without the United States, and it was still sort of passing resolutions. It continued to have some of the larger Western democracies as part of it. It was still, to a lesser extent, holding investigations into sort of the worst human rights abuses. So it's hard to say whether overall the council, for example, lose credibility with sort of the broader international audiences or governments. But that would just sort of be my sort of initial reaction, and I think we're just going to kind of have to wait and see.
Ambassador Haley spoke about the goals the U.S. had over the last year with the Human Rights Council. She said the U.S. acted in good faith, but that reforms weren't happening. Here's a little more of what she had to say.
One of our central goals was to prevent the world's worst human rights abusers from gaining Human Rights Council membership. What happened? In the past year, the Democratic Republic of Congo was elected as a member. The DRC is widely known to have one of the worst human rights records in the world. Even as it was being elected to membership in the Human Rights Council, mass graves continued to be discovered in the Congo. Another of our goals was to stop the council from protecting the world's worst human rights abusers. What happened? The council would not even have a meeting on the human rights conditions in Venezuela. Why? Because Venezuela is a member of the Human Rights Council.
Mike, can you talk about that issue, human rights abusers, notorious ones in some cases, sitting on this Human Rights Council?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is sort of a perennial issue, and this goes back even into the negotiations on the creation of the council as sort of a successor to the Human Rights Commission, which really was truly widely discredited, and most, especially Western democracies, kind of insisted that this thing change. I think it's worth noting at this point in time that this complaint of the United States and the Trump administration, and is also one that's shared by other Western states, and also largely shared by every other administration in the United States, U.S. administration, going back to the council's creation. So really the only difference here is what the administration did about it, which is to actually withdraw rather than to seek to sort of influence change from inside the council as a member of that council. I think it's certainly the way the fact that the Democratic Republic of Congo was elected, I mean, most of these elections take place at the regional level. And so if the other governments in that region decide that this is who they're going to put up, then unless you get deep changes to the actual membership criteria, meaning like that there's some sort of threshold that we would set to say you have to have this rating as a government in order to participate or to join, there's really no sort of structural way that you can force countries, force regions to pick one country over another. I think what the U.S. historically and today have tried to do is get an agreement that there has to be some minimal threshold to be elected to the council to potentially even be able to run. It's hard to imagine in practice that you could get agreement on what that system would look like or who would get to decide what that threshold is. But I think that that's certainly a longstanding complaint, as the current system has allowed pretty serious human rights abusers with pretty weak human rights practices to be able to sit on the council. Really, again, the difference comes down to what to do about it and how you can get that accomplished.
Talking to Michael Schroeder from American University's School of International Service, talking about the U.S. withdrawal from the U.N. Human Rights Council. We heard from Rick on Facebook. Rick says the U.S. is a world leader in protecting human rights and helping those in need. He says we don't have to be part of a paper lion like the U.N. to fulfill our role in the world. So, Mike, can we do a lot in the United States if we want to protect human rights without being part of this controversial organization?
Yes, that's a good question, right? I mean, and it comes down to what you assume that the purpose of this, like, UN Human Rights Council is. I think if you assume that its primary function was created was to be the global enforcer or the global protector of human rights and really sort of be an independent legal investigatory body that could then actually impose penalties on countries who fell short, I think you're going to be deeply disappointed. And I'm not sure the United States wants that. I think it's certainly not clear that the United States, any U.S. administration, wants a council that is free of political influence. They want to be able to protect and their friends and allies, much as other great powers seek to protect their friends and allies. But I think the better way to think about what the Human Rights Council does is to sort of think about it in the broader sort of international human rights architecture, and that includes sort of domestic bilateral relations we have where we sort of tie, in particular sometimes military and other assistance, to countries' human rights records, and we can certainly continue to use that lever. Regional organizations in both in the Americas, but also, you know, working with our partners elsewhere to help them build up capacity. So it's only one piece of it all, and I think the United States can still work through bilateral and other regional and organizations. That being said, I do think that there is a risk that the Human Rights Council itself doesn't get to enjoy some of the benefits that would come with the United States being actively engaged in it, and therefore it would weaken one piece of that overall architecture. So I do think that to that extent, if your long-term goal is to strengthen human rights around the world, I think that it's probably going to be hurt a little bit. At this point in time, the Trump administration, it's sort of where human rights fits into its larger foreign policy strategy. I've sort of heard Ambassador Haley's comments, but when you think sort of more broadly about sort of what the president has said in terms of what he sees as priorities in places like North Korea and dealing with the ISIS threat in Syria, human rights hasn't always risen to the top, at least on a lot of the sort of issues that get the spotlight. So I think that will be at least as important to the United States' ability to continue to use even its bilateral leverage, since it's withdrawing from this kind of multilateral forum.
Do we have a thing like you were describing, the Human Rights Council not being an independent arbiter that generally everybody agrees, yeah, these are the ones you look to investigate claims of human rights abuses and maybe to have some kind of sanctions?
So I think we should, I think at the resolution, the political body itself, I think, is very much a political body, right? The membership where the government sit and pass resolutions. That being said, the council, a couple of the big improvements from the perspective of human rights advocates with the creation of the council in 2006 was, number one, that they did strengthen and give a much bigger role to what they would call human rights experts who do the investigations. And these are established almost exclusively human rights lawyers, oftentimes who are very well recognized in the field, who are empowered, given mandates by the council to go in and investigate. In fact, they've investigated to the extent possible with Syria. Often that meant having to sort of work particularly with sort of refugee populations, and gain firsthand accounts from them, but North Korea, and that these investigations and even the threat of having them publicly discussed often has led to some, you know, some pretty serious diplomatic pressure. It's not going to turn the tide of war. It's not going to get governments to sort of turn over what they see as fundamental interests. But it has, for example, I think some of the investigations into Syria have sort of led to pressure on Russia to allow humanitarian missions and mandates to go through, even in the Security Council. North Korea, when it was being investigated in the Human Rights Council, was threatening to send that report up to the Security Council. In fact, suddenly the doors opened and cooperation with the investigator became significantly better. So that piece of it is sort of a more investigatory, sort of expert-driven process. This other big piece, I think, is what we call the Universal Periodic Review. And this is, I think, one of the big concessions that the United States and a lot of other advocates of the newly created Human Rights Council got out of those 06 talks, which was that there would be a process where every few years, every member of the UN system would have to go through a peer review of its human rights practices. Now, I think you'd be naive to think that this is a politics-free review. Nonetheless, when a country is up for review, and again, nobody can escape scrutiny here, every country must periodically go through it, the group of countries that lead the way is expected to pull together reports from experts, to pull together information reports from civil society groups, which is a pretty major step, right? When governments don't tend to prefer to be able to self-report their human rights practices and outcomes, to suddenly civil society getting a say in what these reports say. And while you know, some parts of the deliberations around the findings are public and others are private, this was seen as a major step forward. And even if the outcomes of those reports weren't, again, like a legal adjudication of the evidence, at least the fact that they couldn't escape some sort of periodic review shone a spotlight on those countries' practices, and that often helped mobilize domestic support for human rights activists and help them link up with international activists and so forth. And so that could be used to kind of nudge countries towards slightly better human rights practices. And for countries who actually often were transitioning from sort of more authoritarian regimes and wanted to get better at human rights practices, that became a process for them to actually kind of learn. And it tended to create a mechanism for some sort of peer engagement where you could share technical expertise bilaterally or multilaterally.
Talking to Mike Schroeder from American University's School of International Service. He's with us to talk about the U.S. decision to pull out of the U.N. Human Rights Council. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? What signal do you think this sends to the rest of the world? If you're critical of the UN and this Human Rights Council, tell us why. And if you worry about the U.S. role in promoting human rights around the world, let us know that too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation about why the United States decided to pull out of the UN Human Rights Council and what it might mean for diplomatic relations in the future. Mike Schroeder stays with us, Assistant Dean at American University's School of International Service. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with the decision to leave the Human Rights Council? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Greg on Facebook. Greg says the move clearly tells brutal leaders around the world that the U.S. doesn't care anymore and they can go ahead. Mike, do you worry that this could be seen as a green light from the United States that we're opting out of human rights enforcement?
So it's a really good question, and I think you see this raised. I think a number of human rights activists in particular become very nervous about this, often when it's seen in the context of other sort of foreign policy decisions where human rights haven't been put at the forefront. You know, I think this is going to make it easier. It's one less vote in the council. So if you want to pass a resolution on Israel, I think it's going to be easier for the council to do that moving forward than it was when the United States, and there's actually evidence to support this, when the United States was part of the council. It significantly dropped both the number of special sessions held on Israel, but also significantly dropped just the number of one-off resolutions. Went down to about 20% of resolutions from what it was, which was an overwhelmingly large number than that. So I think on that front, in terms of will authoritarian leaders think that somehow this means that that human rights are not on the international agenda, and that they will pay, that they'll either, their abuses will not either be discovered or potentially face some form of shaming, I think that would probably be a bit strong. I don't think the U.S. role is so definitive inside the council that that'll change the council. I mean, it still has the U.N.'s imprimatur, and so for countries that, you know, want the, that matters, I think that the council will continue to play a role there.
Let's talk about that Israel issue that was specifically raised by Ambassador Haley and others as a reason to leave. A lot of people I've seen, even people who say, yes, Israel has human rights problems in occupied territories, even people say that, then say, but proportionally, they get way more attention from the Human Rights Council than a lot of other countries with abuses of their own. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a longstanding criticism that is, that sort of goes beyond even, you know, again, the United States. Certainly, the Trump administration is by no means new. This is a criticism that came starting with the Bush administration and was one of the reasons they chose not to initially join when they created the council. In fact, it was one of the reasons that the Obama administration decided to join, was that they wanted to have that influence. And in fact, again, the CFR, the Council for Foreign Relations, has a report that kind of documents what that influence was, especially in terms of outcomes. It hasn't changed, on the other hand, the fact that the Israel retains a single agenda item on that council, a standing agenda item, is tied to Israel. So I think that has certainly been a long-standing issue in the council, that Israel remains literally a standing item for the council, never mind the sort of one-offs. But again, those decreased significantly under the President Obama's sort of time in office, and it's not clear. So that's, I think it remains open whether withdrawing will have a positive impact there or even undercut those resolutions in terms of in the eyes of those who look to them.
Let's go to a caller now. Brian is with us in Fort Atkinson. Brian, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think this is, well, it won't help. I mean, I'd rather think that we should be part of that or remain in that that would be more of an influence.
Gotcha. Brian, thanks for that call. So better to have a seat at the table, even if it's a flawed organization, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brian's point as well is sort of well taken by a lot of sort of activists who either look to the President Obama's era and look to the sort of influence, the nudging forward as they saw it on the agenda. Human Rights Watch has made a sort of very similar statement. I mean, I think the other way to think about Brian's question or sort of comment is whether the United States can actually not just change individual resolutions on, and how much Israel is the focus of those resolutions, but can they actually get the changes, negotiate the changes that they want to the council from the outside? That, it's not clear to me, or at least I haven't seen any evidence from the administration yet that would support that view. Withdrawal, I think the one thing withdrawal does is it puts a media spotlight on the immediate practices of the council. And so at least in the short run, it has put a spotlight, including on some of the weaknesses of the council. How that translates into long-term bargaining leverage to get changes that have frankly been very hard to, it's hard to achieve so far, I think remains a bit of a mystery to me.
Ryan, thanks for that call. Go next to Matthew in Madison. Matthew, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering about the optics and timing of this. I find it ironic just with our current immigration crisis at the border and also Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un and touting how great a leader he is with all the human rights violations there.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, without, you know, I have no inside information into how the ultimate decision was taken. I think the optics, though, is a good question. You know, again, the Trump administration has made clear that this was on their plate, you know, last year, and certainly then I took seriously the possibility that they might act on that threat. So I do think it has been part of their longer-term agenda. That being said, you know, it's hard to see in what context it's taken place. You know, it may be around sort of issues that were brought up around, you know, wanting to sort of signal to authoritarian leaders that if they're willing to cut deals on other issues, that matter to the United States as President Trump sees our national interests, that he's willing to give them a pass on human rights. It may be, you know, his sort of resentment at the Human Rights Council last week, sort of having the High Commissioner for Human Rights really sort of pretty bluntly criticize U.S. immigration policy and U.S. Refugee rights protections. And the other context, though, that it might be worth thinking about it is in the sort of president's sort of apparent sort of and rhetorical disdain anyway, if not outright disdain, for multilateral agreements and institutions writ large. So this could just be seen as another indication whether it was pulling out of the Iran deal or pulling out of the Paris agreements. So it's really hard to get a sense of what drives this. But I think that, and I think the optics are going to kind of depend on what context you see this decision being taken.
In our last few moments, Mike, a lot of people have pointed toward a growing trend toward authoritarian governments in many countries around the world. Are you worried that human rights are going to be taking more of a back seat in the years, maybe decade to come?
You know, that's a great question. You know, we definitely have seen around the world, and there's lots of evidence to support this kind of democratic backsliding, both in terms of actual moves to authoritarianism and then sort of some troubling authoritarian kind of attitudes developing even in some more stable democracies. I would say that the period of human rights, I think if you're comparing it to kind of the heyday of the 90s, which is where I grew up, and we sort of thought, you know, with the United States, quote-unquote, winning the Cold War and democracy ascendant, we would see kind of human rights advance, not perfectly and not linearly, but in fits and starts, but, you know, towards an ultimate positive end. I think if we look at the broader sweep in history, I think you can see that we're at a point that's going to be a difficult one for the Human Rights Project. And what we took as assumptions in the 90s and early 2000s, I absolutely don't think we can take as assumptions that human rights will be at the forefront of many countries' priorities.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Michael Schroeder from American University's School of International Service, talking about the United States' decision to pull out of the UN Human Rights Council, that decision announced last week.